In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome to the iSpire Radio Show, where every week we help you keep an eye on big government. With the possible exception of the IRS, there is no government agency that has the potential for more abuse than the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. The potential for abuse and overreach for the EPA, by the EPA, is enormous. We've all heard the horror stories of the EPA alleging one environmental violation or another, and they swoop in and shut down companies, or entire industries. And the only thing protecting you or your company is the law and the processes that have been established. Think of it this way. If the government wanted to arrest you for something, the law protects you from abuse by the government. The government, under normal situations, has to follow due process, Miranda rights, access to an attorney, and so forth. The exception here is the prisoners in Gitmo Bay. They were locked up without due process, but that's another show. The EPA has become that. They're like the Guantanamo Bay of the environmental world. In the case of the Pebble Mine, which you may remember from last year, they were trying to deny a company its due process by colluding with environmental groups, tribes, and others to stop a mine before they even filed the permit. Except the EPA got caught red-handed. On today's show, we'll check in with Tom Collier, the CEO of the Pebble Partnership, which is continuing its fight against the EPA, and there are some new revelations in their case. But up first, we'll talk with Lawrence Kogan about a law that's on the books to protect people from abuse, the IQA, the Information Quality Act. I'd like to welcome Lawrence Kogan of the Kogan Law Group. Lawrence has more than 25 years experience in a host of legal areas, including the environment, as well as planning and policy. He is trying to raise awareness about the extent and seriousness of the current campaign by left-leaning activists, academics, and foreign governments who are waging war on the American free market system, on private property, and on science. Lawrence, it's good to talk to you today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I appreciate that.
You know, the serious people that follow the environment would probably not be too surprised that the foreign governments are involved in waging this war, but the average person is probably not aware that that sort of thing's happening. I assume you're talking about the UN and some of these other nutso environmental policies that we have coming our way.
See, really, everybody looks at the UN as the mark to follow. The UN is an international body, but it's comprised of member governments.
Yes.
So really, national governments comprise the UN and dictate really what policy direction it goes in. But the environmental health and safety regulatory policies that are ruining medium and small-sized businesses across the country really start from Europe. European Union, after starting in 1992 when they had their Maastricht Treaty, figured out that they would be more powerful in the world if they were grouped together. First in an economic coal and steel agreement back in the 50s, but eventually they would become a federation of European states, like much like the United States is a federation of 50 separate states. And part of their effort has been to promote sustainable development. That is their main policy agenda in Europe, it seems.
Yes.
And sustainable development, as you may be aware, is a late 20th century uneasy compromise between the forces of capitalism and the forces of Marxism. And
yeah.
We have documented that in a law review article that we had written for the Kentucky School of Law.
Yeah,
University of Kentucky School of Law.
Yeah, we're very aware of sustainable development and how it is not exactly what it purports to be.
Right, and it has a green first agenda, which is based on a mixed economy of Europe, which is pretty much in a socialist leaning. It's based on the social compact of Jean-Jacques Rousseau rather than the social compact of John Locke that we have as the basis for our social compact in this country.
Yeah.
Which means it perceives the role of government very differently.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that you're currently working on is ensuring regulatory agency transparency and accountability especially the EPA, via the U.S. Information Quality Act. And our next guest, Tom Collier of the Pebble Mine, I'm sure can certainly appreciate that, because they've been routinely stonewalled by the EPA to get information out of them. This is including the EPA hiding a witness, losing emails, and so forth. But, you know, we see this a lot with the EPA and other agencies like the IRS losing their emails. That law, the Information Quality Act, what kind of teeth does that have?
Well, see, the thing is, it's unfortunately, it by itself is a very short statute. But when you start digging into the legislative history, as we have, you'll find that it really is part of a much larger statutory effort called the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1995, which was an effort of the Al Gore Reinvent Government Initiative, about which everyone should be suspicious.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I certainly find very suspicious about that is the notion that one of the pieces of paper that they stopped tracking was the payments going to environmental groups under these sue and settle types of lawsuits.
Right, but you got to go back to the 70s. A lot of those statutes were enacted in the 1970s when we had a runaway system. It's when the liberals were going crazy and they were dominating Congress. And at that point, the Republicans had very little influence. Not to say that they're any different from the liberals now, but the fact is then it was a one-way street. And all of this citizen suit type of legislation was enacted at that point, which is now being used by environmental groups to sue the agency to then prompt a settlement. And that's a way, an indirect way, that we taxpayers fund environmental groups.
Right. And what I was referring to there was Karen Bud Phelan, who's a previous guest of ours here on iSpy, has said that you can't track those payments. So due to the Paperwork Reduction Act, if you go to the Department of Justice and say, how much have you paid the friends of this or the defenders of that, they can't tell you. You actually have to dig into the individual court cases to find out the amounts of payments that have been made. Getting into the Information Quality Act, though, how is that applied? I mean, is it sort of like a FOIA-type request?
No, it's totally different than FOIA. I mean, the Information Quality Act implements part of the Paperwork Reduction Act. Paperwork Reduction Act had two parts. It had the part that would curtail the ability of the federal government to burden stakeholders with information requests, i.e. surveys, et cetera, that would impose both time burden and cost burden on American citizens. That's the pull version, where they pull information out of Americans. They also have a portion of the Paperwork Reduction Act, which was a push version of a portion of the statute, which basically was the information that federal agencies would push out to the public in the form of, you know, science assessments, technical statistical assessments, and other types of information, including rules and regulations that shouldn't burden in an oppressive way the same stakeholders who shouldn't be burdened by the information that was being pulled in by the government. Since during the Clinton administration, Jacob Lew, who was the director of OMB, did not implement regulations to effectuate the push portion of it out as far as what the government can push out to the public, Congress was forced through several enactments during the Gingrich Congress to try to get them to do it. And finally, on the eve of the end of the Clinton administration, they were able to enact the Information Quality Act, which is a very short statute that implements the push portion of the Paperwork Reduction Act. And this is what the liberals have criticized that statute as a rider in an appropriations bill, because they wanted to disparage the statute because they don't want to deal with it.
Okay, it sounds like it's essentially a tool to remove the agency's cloak of invisibility, so to speak. All right, we're going to have more on that when we come back with Lawrence Kogan, and stay tuned. We're also going to talk about the involvement of some tribes as tools of the environmental movement. And we are back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're keeping an eye on big government. Today, our focus is on environmental issues, especially the overreach of federal agencies. To do that, we're talking with Lawrence Kogan. He is with the Kogan Law Group, and he is an attorney specializing in regulatory law. So going into the break, we were talking about the Information Quality Act. And just to be clear, what this is designed to do is to make these agencies justify what they're doing through more rigorous scientific peer reviews and so on, correct?
That's correct. I mean, the IQA really is a process-based statute. It focuses on how the government agencies develop and review all of the information that they put out to the public. And when you get into the science, it also affords stakeholders the ability to scrutinize that the process by which science that agencies use is developed and then peer-reviewed. Now, a lot of the science that agencies use is not internally developed. It's third-party science that the agency acquire, obtain, and embrace. And that then brings up questions of, you know, how does the agency even validate the science that third parties develop? And that's what the IQA, from the perspective of science, is intended to do.
Well, and this reminds me a lot of what we heard about from a whistleblower within the Department of the Interior, I believe it was, talking about the dam removal process down there in the Klamath. And what he found is that they were essentially putting out their junk science. And he wasn't going to stand for that because that was his job, was to actually review the science. But that kind of what you're saying here, the question that you're raising is who gets to choose that peer review panel? Because it sounds like it's like the old saying, it's not who votes, but who counts the votes that matters. And so who gets to actually say that this is good, sound science?
See, the IQA is a very short statute, but there are detailed guidelines that the Office of Management and Budget, specifically their Office of Information Regulatory Affairs, has developed to implement that statute. And those guidelines are really legally binding guidelines that were developed pursuant to a very above-board notice and comment process. So they have precedential value, legally binding precedential value, and the OMB is deferred to when there's any question as to the application of a guideline. That implements IQA. So those guidelines direct agencies to pursue peer review in a certain manner,
and
depending upon the economic significance of the assessment that is being developed and reviewed.
And is there anything similar on the state level? I know we're talking about federal level, but here in Oregon, we've had a situation where the ability to use a motorized dredge has been eliminated. There's a pending moratorium starting January 2nd, 2016, in which you can't use these motorized dredges. And this was all based on very faulty science. They were making all sorts of – it wasn't even actual scientific studies, but there's an indication that, or they believe such mining might harm. There's all this conditional language in there and no hard science. So is there anything similar to that on state levels?
No, unfortunately, no, but states can learn and could, you know, embrace this type of statute at their level, which is what I would encourage because it brings greater transparency and accountability
sure.
to state agencies.
Sure. Well, one of the things, and I hate to jump forward like this because this sounds like an important thing that we need to have you back on, and I do know that when we do have you back, we want to talk to you a little bit more about a current case that you're involved in, and this is the removal of a dam there in Montana, I believe. What we're seeing more and more is the EPA and some of these environmentalist groups are using the involvement of tribes, to start pushing whatever agenda it is that they have. And is this something that you're seeing as well all across the nation, or is it kind of more centralized here to the Northwest and up in Alaska? I know they're doing the same thing.
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, the federal Indian policy is being pushed around the country. It's just acute in the Pacific Northwest because of all the water and the reservations out here. And the federal Indian policy accords federally recognized tribal entities very many preferences, including a number of regulatory waivers and exemptions that other private parties would not be entitled to. It's a way in which the federal government ostensibly claims that it is righting the wrongs of the past. But it does more than just right the wrongs of the past. It gives them an affirmative bias going forward that one could make the argument is racially motivated.
Well, it does sometimes seem like that, and I guess the other aspect of it is the PR side of things, where if things say, well, you have all of these different tribes involved, and they're trying to regain their historic water rights or their fishing rights or whatever, I suppose there's some sympathy on that, but it's interesting when you see them shut down things like the Klamath Basin and then some of these other dams and whatnot, because I can never quite figure out what the tribes get out of this. I mean, what's their real motive there? Is there money exchanging hands? I mean, I can't imagine that the tribal councils really want to squash things like ranching or farming or other types of job growth.
Well, the tribes go back to the, you know, they all always go back to their treaties with the U.S. government from the 19th century. And those treaties have been interpreted by very activist courts as being, you know, they construe these treaty terms in favor of the tribes, claiming that they, you know, they should be afforded this preference because they don't understand the quote-unquote white man's ways, at least at that point in history. But these treaties have been used to open up all types of opportunities for the tribes, some of which obviously are trying to grant them economic opportunity. But there is a way that the federal government uses the tribal recognition status for its own benefit.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but this the involvement of the tribes in the environmental movement is something that we're going to have to certainly explore more in depth on a later show. Lawrence, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And you're listening to the iSpy Radio Show, keeping an eye on big government. Often of late, it seems there is no greater example of big government intrusion than environmental areas, stopping logging, stopping mining, stopping ranching, and so on via unelected government bureaucrats. And there's probably no greater poster child of this sort of intrusion at work than what has happened to the Pebble Mine, some 100 miles inland from the Bristol Bay in Alaska, where the EPA, in an unprecedented use of its power, preemptively shut down the project without even allowing it to go into the permit process. I'd like to welcome back Tom Collier. He's the CEO for Pebble Partnership. Tom, it's good to talk to you again today.
Well, it's nice talking to you. Thank you for having me back on your show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the last time we talked with you was in December of 2014. I assume that everything's just fine now and you're open for business.
Sure. We're, we're digging holes and punching out copper and gold. We're still in the same battle,
wow.
Although, you know, the fascinating part is that when I talked to you a year ago, that was about the time that we had really designed our strategy and we had begun the implementation of all of the pieces of it. You know, now we're at a place where we've gotten some traction with a lot of the strategy.
Good.
It's a very different feel to actually believe that, you know, I always believe we're going to prevail, but now we've actually got some evidence that we're making progress toward prevailing, and that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
And it's had an impact. We've been able to raise some more money in the market, we're eager for our conversations with major mining companies that might want to step up and be a partner, and we've got a judge who's taking a hard look at the misconduct by EPA and a number of other forums where that's being examined. So we feel like finally people are listening to us.
Good. That's very encouraging. And you mentioned about getting some other mining companies on board with you guys. Remind our audience about the Pebble Mine project itself, just how big of a project this is, and then some of those legal challenges in particular that your company is facing.
Well, this is the single largest deposit, undeveloped deposit of gold and copper in the world. It's located in southwest Alaska, and we've had challenges raised by the environmental community who claim that building a mine in this area is the wrong thing to do because it's such a pristine area and because it's near a salmon fishery. Salmon fisheries well over 100 miles away, and we're confident we're going to build a mine that is safe and sound with respect to environmental concerns and questions. Several years ago, EPA decided that they were going to stop our project by using a never-used interpretation of the Clean Water Act, and they have proposed restrictions on development in this watershed that would preclude us from building a mine. And they've done it even before we filed a permit application. So they had to kind of make up what they thought we were going to build in order to stop us from building it. It's just outrageous, the conduct that's happened. And more recently, as we have gotten more and more documents, we're discovering, of course, that there was extensive collusion with some of the environmental activists that were involved up here, and that they were working as though they were employees of EPA. And wow. It also appears that that EPA unmistakably, Region 10, made up its mind that it was going to try to shut down our project even before they did what they call their scientific study. And here's the real bombshell, and that is that, you know, we've been saying this, and everybody says, oh, you've got an axe to grind. So we went out and retained somebody that we thought had the best reputation for independence and credibility in the American political system today. And the guy we chose is an ex-senator and ex-secretary of defense, Bill Cohen. And we asked Bill to do an independent investigation of the things I just said to you. And he published his report just about a month ago, and he is extraordinarily critical of the use of this process, period, thinks that it's the wrong thing to do when there's a complex project like ours that's being challenged, that instead you should use the well-worn pathway of doing an environmental impact statement. But second, he recognized that, the documents raise serious questions as to whether EPA didn't have a predetermined result and manipulate the process to accomplish that result. And Bill's a careful guy, the secretary, Secretary Cohen, and he wouldn't have reached these conclusions if there wasn't sound reason for doing so. And in fact, his 350-page report details every one of the documents, every one of the reasons, and it's unassailable. And as a result of that, now the Congress is at least one committee scheduled hearings, and I think a couple of other are giving consideration to scheduling hearings. So I think this is all going to come out now.
Well, that's very encouraging. How much of that report that he filed can be used? I mean, obviously it can be used in congressional hearings and whatnot, but can that be submitted as part of your legal evidence as well?
Well, you know, I think there's some ways where it might ultimately be relevant, frankly. You know, the government has continued to take a position with the court that nothing nefarious was going on here. And at some point, having the Cohen report entered into evidence to show that that there certainly is a basis for concluding that there was misconduct occurring, might be an appropriate thing to do. But right now in our litigation, we're engaged in discovery. And so we have reached out to EPA and to a number of those who were engaged in cooperating with EPA, and even some that we think were engaged in collusion with EPA. And we're asking for their documents. And some are giving us their documents, and some, of course, are fighting us.
Yeah, I was going to say others are probably making good use of their burn barrels out back. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. And when we come back, I want to talk to you some more about that collusion. Everyone stay with us. Lots more with Tom Collier, CEO of the Pebble Partnership. And welcome back. We're checking in with Tom Collier. He's the CEO for Pebble Partnership, which is trying to launch the Pebble Mine some 100 miles from Bristol Bay in Alaska. If they can get past the EPA, which decided to shut them down, the mine is sitting on tens of billions of dollars in gold, copper, and other mineral reserves. So, Tom, going into the break there, we were talking about some of the collusion there, and you guys were talking about some of the discovery process. As I recall, last time we talked, they had one key witness there at the EPA. I forget his first name. His last name was North, I believe. And he just suddenly up and disappeared from the EPA, and nobody seemed to be able to track him down. Did you guys ever find him?
Well, he has run off. He appears to have fled the country in order to avoid a threatened subpoena that one of the congressional committees was going to issue. And the rumor is he's somewhere in New Zealand. We've had in our litigation here, the court has issued an order that allows us to subpoena his attendance at a deposition here in Alaska. And what we're going to try to do is track him down and give it to him. If we can do that, then we'll be moving ahead. So that's the current plan. So,
wow.
But Phil's done a lot of crazy things. You know, Phil's a guy who, before he left, his computer crashed.
Yeah.
And they tried to recover documents from it. He also had a thumb drive where files on it had been encrypted and the government couldn't get into those files. And he also used his private email instead of his government email so that people couldn't track his email communications. So there's something going on there with what Mr. North is working on, and hope someday we can get the whole story.
Well, I hate to say it, but it certainly seems very much par for the course with the Obama administration, which was touting itself as the most transparent. I think they've become transparent, but certainly in another way, because this idea of the shell game, hiding it on different computers, the computers crash, the emails are suddenly unavailable. I mean, we're just seeing this all the time now. Is this the future of transparency? Is that they just are going to hide under an electronic cover?
Well, you know, we're in an age where everything you say can be discovered, and so people that are up to nefarious activity try to hide their communications. Used to be you could walk over in the corner of a room and whisper to each other, and now you have to have an encrypted file on your computer, or you've got to use a private email address, even though that's contrary to law, in order to hide your communications. And it doesn't surprise me that when people are engaged in planning activities that are contrary to the law, they do it in a way that is also contrary to the law by hiding their communications.
Yeah, really. Well, as part of your discovery process, what are some of the things that you guys are learning? I know that it seems like when they wanted to shut you guys down, they were using some rather dubious science, and it was all based on models. And, I mean, we see this a lot with global warming and whatnot, too, where they use these models and projections. And very rarely does it ever come down to actual hard science. So what were some of the issues that you guys were seeing with that?
Well, we have learned an enormous amount. The first thing we've learned is that this has always been argued by EPA that the reason they began to come after Pebble Mine and close it down is because a handful of Alaskan Native tribes filed petitions with them asking them to do that. Well, it turns out that, in fact, 6 months before those petitions were filed, a person who works at EPA and a person in the environmental activists here in Alaska got together, and they drafted the petitions. The tribes didn't draft the petitions. And they drafted them together now. So this is EPA drafting a petition that was filed with EPA. And then those petitions were circulated to the Indian tribes and the Native tribes, and they signed them. Whether someone twisted their arm or not, we won't know until we start taking depositions. But it is interesting that 6 months before the Native tribes expressed this position, EPA and environmental activists were drafting the petition. So, it looks to us like they were using the petitions from the tribes as cover to get this activity off the ground. But even more shocking is that even before these petitions were filed, the same guy and an environmental activist he was working with drafted a decision memo for the regional administrator so that he could decide what to do once these petitions were filed. So the first thing is they're drafting the decision memo before the petitions have even been filed. The second thing is the decision memo only has options in it that would kill the project. The third thing is this is a decision memo being drafted for the regional administrator of EPA that's being drafted by an environmental activist. somebody outside the agency that's working against our project is actually drafting the decision memo. And then when that's published in the Wall Street Journal, the regional administrator writes a letter to the Wall Street Journal and denies the fact that he ever saw the decision memo. And he said that, you know, this actually had no impact because it was a document he never saw. Well, we have four emails that show that he did see the decision memo, and he held a meeting about the decision memo. So he had misled the public in his letter to the editor of the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal called him on it. It wrote another story saying that he had misled the public in this denial, and he then went radio silent, hasn't said a word since. So. So, you know, there's something going on there. It looks to us like, you know, Region 10 got itself way out on a limb and looked for a way to kill this project and kept trying to come up with things that would make that happen. And so they encouraged tribes to file a petition. They drafted decision memos with the environmental activists that were involved in this. They denied that they did certain things when, in fact, it's clear they did do those things. So as this all comes out, our case gets stronger and stronger, and ultimately we hope to prevail. Now, the really interesting thing here is that prevailing doesn't mean we get to go start digging a mine. Prevailing means that we get to file an application for a permit like every single other person in America that's ever wanted to build something under the Clean Water Act. Mm. So, you know, that's all we're after, is just give us due, fair process.
Sure.
And the government's denying it, absolutely denying it at this point.
Wow, just absolutely stunning. All right, lots more with Tom Collier, CEO for the Pebble Partnership, coming up. Going to be talking a little bit more about why they did this. Stay with us. And we're back talking today to Tom Collier, the CEO for the Pebble Partnership, talking about their ongoing struggle with the EPA. The Pebble Mine is sitting on tens of billions of dollars in gold, copper, and other minerals, but has been blocked by the EPA before even being allowed to submit their permit to their website. If you'd like to go visit that, is pebblepartnership.com. They've got lots of information up there. And you guys, I assume, you have regular news updates and whatnot there?
We do.
Okay, great. So one of the things that you're talking about there is that they went out of their way to kill this. They were doing this preemptively, as you said, even before the permitting process was allowed to go forward. So I guess this begs the question, why? Why would they want to kill this before you guys even submit a permit?
Well, you know, the that's a question ultimately that someday maybe they will answer. But it seems to me that the reason that they have done that is they're afraid that when we get into the rigorous, comprehensive, exhaustive permitting process, that we'll prevail, that we'll get a permit. Hmm. And so they're trying to pull the rug out from under us before we get into that permit. Look, we've invested nearly $800 million.
Wow.
Getting ready to go into permitting. So we're ready for it. We've got answers to the environmental challenges that have been posed. We have designed the most environmentally protective project in the history of mining in the world. And so we're pretty confident we're going to get a permit. I think EPA thinks we'll get a permit too. And that's why they're trying to keep us out of the permit process.
But again, why try to stop this at all? I mean, this is a huge mine you're talking about. As I remember, you're projecting 15,000 jobs. So this is a big boon for the area. So why try to stop this at all?
Well, you know, there are, unfortunately, environmental zealots that are out there that think that we shouldn't do mining, we shouldn't do any timber harvesting, we shouldn't do any drilling, that's a crowd that is becoming more and more powerful, and we got to stand up to them. Listen, I'm a Democrat. I served in the Clinton administration. I worked personally for Bruce Babbitt and worked for Al Gore. I'm not a guy that says you want to cut every tree and and dig a hole in every national park. I believe EPA has a sound role to play, but the guys that are there now, particularly in Region 10, have run the train off the tracks. They violated, I believe, appropriate process. They have engaged in collusion with the environmental community. They predetermined a result here and drove the process to get to that predetermined result. And I submit to you that this is now not just me spouting off. There is a detailed, exhaustive report by a former Democratic Secretary of Defense that says precisely the same thing.
Wow. It seems of late that that whenever there's an environmental opposition to growth or access to natural resources, the environmental left is, and I mean the extreme left, not the people that do want to see some development, but the ones that want to shut down all development. It seems more and more they're involving tribes. Are tribes becoming tools of the environmental left, or are they actual willing active participants, they also want to shut down these types of projects?
I don't think there's a generalization on that issue that's that works. I think it varies from situation to situation. I've worked a lot with Native American tribes in the lower 48, and beginning with my tenure here to work with the Native Alaskan groups in Alaska. And I deeply respect their careful decision-making on issues like this. And I know that a lot of them struggle with development versus environmental protection on their own land and on nearby land. But I've worked with many that think that responsible development is very important to the economic survival of their tribes and are strongly supportive of appropriate natural resource development. And then there are some that take a different perspective, and sometimes I think that some of those organizations perhaps are not as well informed as they might otherwise be. Mm.
Well, you had mentioned in the last segment there that the environmental activists going to the tribes and essentially writing the petitions for them. And you were curious whether or not they were twisting arms. Is it twisting arms, or do you suspect they're getting paid off somehow from behind the scenes, maybe from some of these really well-funded environmental organizations?
Listen, I don't have any evidence that that's happened, and so therefore speculating about it is just the wrong thing to do, particularly on the radio. But it's clear to me that the petitions were written by an EPA employee and an environmental activist. Mm. I think that filing the petitions was their idea, not the tribe's idea, and I think they took that idea to them and convinced them somehow to sign those petitions.
Wow. Okay, let's take a break a little bit early. Coming up, we'll be talking about some of the tools they use to help storm the castle. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us. We're wrapping things up now with Tom Collier. He's the CEO for the Pebble Partnership, which is trying to launch the Pebble Mine about 100 miles or so from the Bristol Bay up in Alaska, sitting on tens of billions of dollars of gold, copper, and other minerals. And, you know, going into the break there, I was talking about you guys use some tools to help start to crack this open. One of the ones that I remember you talking about last year was the FACA, the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And talk to us a little bit about that in terms of how that has been able to open up, begin to expose some of what was going on here in terms of the collusion.
Well, you know, we began this process filing Freedom of Information Act requests, and so we got lots of documents. And what clearly became apparent in those documents was that there were contacts between EPA and environmentalists that were just extraordinary. As to one individual, there were more than 300 separate contacts, over 1,000 with various environmental organizations and individuals. So it raised a question to us as to whether EPA had violated the Federal Advisory Committee Act statute, which is a statute that says if you consult with non-federal employees, you have to set up a formal committee to do it so the consultation will be on the record and so the committee could represent all perspectives and views. And they didn't do that here. So if they were consulting regularly with non-federal employees about the Pebble project, they were violating the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So we took that argument to court. We filed a claim, and after a good bit of wrangling with the government, the judge determined that we had shown that we were likely to succeed on this point and issued a preliminary injunction that says that EPA can no longer pick up a pencil to try to veto or stop our project until this judge gets to make a final decision on our FACA case. The government then filed a motion to dismiss our case, and we went through all this again, all the facts, and the judge again ruled in our favor. And then we get to do discovery. So we get to do depositions. We get to do 35 depositions of EPA employees and environmental activists to ask them what they were doing and what was going on. And we're now starting to get some of the documents in. And the documents show this extraordinarily well-organized a group that that was clearly focused on killing our project, and they were consulting with and helping and working with EPA on a daily basis is a slight exaggeration, but weekly is not, over the course of years. And I think ultimately we're going to win our FACA case, and if we do, the remedy will be that the government won't be able to rely on this Bristol Bay watershed assessment that is the basis for their effort to try to kill our project. And we'll be able to go into permitting at that point.
Well, in terms of using the Federal Advisory Committee Act, is how extensive is that? Is that something that the average everyday citizen, when they suspect that that sort of thing has happened, where there's some sort of collusion between tribes and environmental groups and not reaching across the aisles, so to speak, to people that would be opposed to or in favor of the opposite action, is that something that the average citizen can use, or is it very extensive?
Well, it takes a lot of factual digging. If we hadn't had thousands of documents from the Freedom of Information Act request, we wouldn't have been able to bring our FACA case. And so it is pretty expensive. But I think it's going to get easier to do. And the reason it's going to get easier is because agencies like EPA, and particularly Region 10 of EPA, have so grossly abused the process. And when that kind of abuse happens, then courts, of course, look for ways to give somebody a remedy for that abuse. And this is a statute that could provide that. But the way the current law is, there's some pretty high hurdles that you have to get over at the outset of litigation. And that's a testament to how severe the facts are in our case, is that we were able to get over those hurdles in this particular litigation. And so I think that this case has an opportunity to make some law that others may be able to use in the wake of the ultimate results of what happens with Pebble.
Yeah, and that's actually very ironic in a way, because as I had read just some of the executive summary there from the Cohen report, and within that he talks about the Section 404C that the EPA was trying to use to do this preemptive challenge like this, essentially to not even allow you to get to that permit. So do you think that they were trying to use this whole, I talked to you earlier about why they would do this. Do you think this was really just an attempt for their side to set a precedent that they could start shutting down these things before they even get to permits?
Well, their internal documents say that's the case. It's not speculation anymore. The number one reason given in a briefing for the administrative EPA for doing a veto of Pebble was to establish the precedent for proactive watershed-wide planning in America.
Wow.
And so what they want to do, EPA wants the authority to zone private and state land. And they see this as the precedent to give them that authority. If we let this happen, if the government lets this happen, if Congress does, the courts do, then you get what you get. And what it's going to be is that EPA will have the authority to come in and zone private and state land and say you can no longer develop it.
Wow. That is just absolutely stunning. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there with you today. Tom Collier, CEO of the Pebble Partnership, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Nice talking to you guys.
Well, wasn't that interesting? Setting up a precedent. But imagine for a moment if they'd gotten away with it. The EPA, which already has far too much power, would be able to shut down pretty much any project at will. But here's a question. They got caught in this case. Where else are they trying it? Something to think about. Be sure to check our webpage for more information and to stay up to date, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.